it takes a tremendous amount of perseverance and passion. And I think it's so important that teams truly believe in what they're doing and that they hopefully have a clear understanding of what the clinical benefit is and that, that they then embrace and enjoy the process. And because if you find the process onerous, it's not worth doing, and it shouldn't be onerous if you really understand the number of people who, if you are successful and effective at whatever your therapy is that you're evolving or diagnostic, whatever, that if you keep that in mind, then it inspires the perseverance and the passion and the drive.
And now, from San Francisco and the UCSF Rosenman Institute, the Health Technology Podcast, with your host, Christine Winoto.
Our guest today is Dr. Fred Singor, an entrepreneur, an interventional cardiologist at El Camino Hospital, and vice chairman of the board of the Fogarty Institute. After earning his medical degree at Harvard about 30 years ago, Fred trained in internal medicine and cardiology at Stanford. Fred found Stanford to be an incredible hotbed of entrepreneurship and fit right in. He was on the founding team of HeartPort, which pioneered the technique of port access bypass. Later in this episode, he talks about how HeartPort was a shooting star of a company with a disruptive technology that benefited patients, but which also taught both of us a lot about the market challenges that companies face. And for some of you who don't know, I did work at HeartPort in my early career. HeartPort was acquired by Johnson & Johnson, and by that time, Fred had moved on to help found Evolve, which developed the mitral clip, a catheter-based approach to repair the mitral valve in a beating heart without open heart surgery. In this episode, you learn a lot about innovation, heart surgery, and the Fogarty Institute. And don't forget to check out our two-part interview with Dr. Tom Fogarty, episode 42 and 43. I hope you enjoy our conversation. And if you like what you hear today, please subscribe to our series on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, or Spotify.
Well, thank you for joining me this afternoon here at UCSF Mission Bay. I think a lot of our listener probably wants to hear your background, how, you know, you get into healthcare, like what made you decide to become a cardiologist and then be entrepreneurial cardiologist as well.
Well, you're starting with the big question right off the bat, Christine. Well, first of all, thanks for having me here. This is a pleasure to come up to the city. I mean, I'm down on the peninsula, Palo Alto area, and it's very beautiful when you come into the city and the sun is shining and the it's spectacular. So thank you very much. Cardiology, I've had a really an amazing and very, I feel very fortunate, a lot of gratitude for having a really rewarding career in medicine. My parents were both doctors, so I did everything I could to avoid it. And at sort of my senior year in college, decided, boy, that I probably don't have any other skills. I probably should be a doctor. I spent a year in Europe working in a physiology laboratory, and so I started thinking about cardiovascular medicine then. And then I went to medical school in Boston. And actually, what probably the most memorable part of medical school was when I spent 6 weeks in down in Central America in Colombia, and I was working in an oral hospital that had basically nothing, and they introduced an EKG machine when I was there. So one of the jobs that I took on and took very seriously was teaching all the staff how to use the EKG machine. And she had a couple of people come in with heart attacks during those 6 weeks. And I am really amazed and awed when I think back about how we treated them. We gave them a little blood thinner and a little morphine. And so I came back from that, and cardiology was just really starting to ramp up then. We didn't do very much. This was in the early 80s. We didn't do much for heart attacks, but I was inspired just by the whole physiology and the fact that we really could manage patients and intervene. It was medicine, but it was still interventional medicine, and it started to grow. And I've seen over the course of my career some amazing changes in.
Is that after that you went to Stanford, or because
I did, and that's sort of where I really got the bug. I mean, Stanford is, as you well know, all I suspect everyone listening to this knows, was a hotbed of activity, continues to be. Mm-hmm. This was in the mid-80s, and John Simpson had developed the balloon angioplasty, and he was one of our mentors. Dr. Tom Fogarty mm-hmm. was around. He had done the Fogarty catheter. I worked directly with Dr. Paul Yock. He mm-hmm. was sort of my mentor. And he was developing intravascular imaging. And mm-hmm. that was, as a fellow, that was the first project I got involved with and did some of the very first intravascular imaging in patients. Mm-hmm. It was hard not to just to appreciate how exciting it was to do something that was really game-changing, paradigm-shifting, revolutionary. So mm-hmm. I really got the bug at that point in my fellowship.
You think if you were, say, in a different place, it's not you would, I mean, would you have that, you think? Because some people can be like, they were entrepreneurial since they were like, you know, selling lemonade when they're like 10 years old. And then so they always have the entrepreneurial spirits. So you think that...
That's a good question. And I think honestly, had I been going to medical school in Kentucky or some other place, I clearly would have just been a just run-of-the-mill doctor and wouldn't have been thinking. But it was such just an inspiring ecosystem, such mm-hmm. a fertile, and people were just thinking about, yes, how can we treat this patient today, but how can we do an even better job? Mm-hmm. And it was basically, we were all drinking the Kool-Aid. Mm-hmm. And I don't think there are probably other places, so it was hard for me not to drink that Kool-Aid. It's kind of delicious.
Like, it's like a pool of Kool-Aid. So you were at Stanford, and then I know you're involved with HeartBoard. Is the HeartBoard the first one? I mean, I know you said that with Paul Yock.
Well, cardiovascular imaging systems. And then I was, as I was sort of winding down in my fellowship, I was approached by John Stevens, basically with a drawing and some napkins, on some napkins about how to possibly replace the aortic valve by putting a valve on a catheter. Mm-hmm. And he's a cardiac surgeon, just a brilliant cardiac surgeon at the time. He was going through his training at the same time I was going through mine. And he said, Fred, what do you think? You think, mm-hmm. Would you like to get involved in this? And I mean, I he didn't even have to twist my arm a quarter of a kink. I was on board.
Yeah. And I mean, so for our listeners, just so you people know, that John Stevens is the founder of HeartBoard. Maybe you can.
John Stevens was a cardiac surgery resident mm-hmm. At Stanford, a resident of Dr. Shumway. Really one of the wonder kids coming through the program, a real visionary. And he and his medical student friend, Wes Sturman, basically together cooked up this idea of replacing the aortic valve with a catheter. And that's the point I got involved. They needed some hands-on people, some clinical people mm-hmm. as sort of a reality check and to do some of the very early early work on that. And we worked on that project for a little while. And then... one of the folks, Larry Siegel, who was an anesthesiologist, came up while he was watching us in the animal lab. Mm-hmm. We would had video scopes, and we actually would put the video scopes in as we were introducing the technology through the arterial system. And he was looking in, he said, well, look, we can see the left anterior descending there. We could easily, through these video scopes, probably do bypass surgery.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I did not know that.
And that was the turning point. That was the key. And they called it the VPI. And they called it VPI because it was the village pub idea, because Larry and John and Wes talked about this one night at a dinner at the village pub. So for the longest time, the company was called Stanford Surgical Technologies originally. We called it Super Secret Technologies.
Right.
And VPI was the idea. And that was when the system to deliver the valve, which was very complex. It was really a Rube Goldberg system, very complex, much more complex than what is now done. Mm-hmm. But still, the patents are based off that's done. But there was a balloon that was basically that was expanded in the ascending aorta. And with that, we were going to stop the heart mm-hmm. and then deploy the valve. We felt we had to stop the heart. And it was then that Larry was looking at the stopped heart through the scope, said, wait, you guys need to do bypass surgery. And that then transitioned into what then became HeartPort, which was port access bypass surgery.
Okay, now that's interesting. I did not know the story. I mean, I work at HeartPort. HeartPort was one of the big story of medtech that time.
Hartbort was a wonderful shooting star.
Yeah.
And I compare Hartbort to IBM, to Hewlett-Packard. And why do I say that? I say that because there were so many people who came in through the door of Hartbort. It was a wonderful idea. They got a phenomenal amount of interest, phenomenal amount of resources thrown at it. I mean, it became at one point, early on, a $1 billion
right.
market cap when it went public company, and totally overblown in terms of what its potential was.
Right.
And didn't embrace and understand the real challenges of introducing totally paradigm-shifting technology. And it really was that.
Right.
I mean, disruptive to the max.
Yeah.
And all the different agendas that it just flew in the face of. And so for Wall Street and everyone else to give it that valuation was totally inappropriate.
Mm-hmm.
And the problem being is the folks who were involved in it sort of fed off of that.
Right.
And when the clinical reality settled in and things, the sort of the retrenching and the then the slide, it's an amazing, which we say HBS, a model story, and that's
yeah.
Harvard Business School.
Right.
And it has been written up.
Yeah.
There's an as to what to do, but then also more importantly, what not to do in mm-hmm. terms of developing new game-changing, paradigm-shifting technologies. Mm-hmm. And that said, all the different people who came through Hartbort have gone off and had a tremendous impact, really,
right.
seriously tremendous impact in our, you know, yours and my ecosystem.
Right, yeah, no.
You're a good example.
Yeah, well, I had to say it was one of the best experiences in terms of like, you know, company culture.
Do people know what you did there?
Yeah, I think so. But, you know, I think you're right. It's like it brought a lot of great people to the Valley because they recruit from people from all over the country to work at Hartbort. So lesson from Hartbort, what you learn, like what do you learn from it that you apply to your next adventures after that Hartbort?
Again, that's an entertaining question because the first thing I learned is when I learned that coming in shortly after a founder, you got to make a lot of noise if you want to have a little bit of equity in the company because there was a group of us who came in and helped out early on who almost got zero equity. And when the company went public, that was a shocker for us. But more importantly, I think what a lot of us learned, and maybe you did too, is just the real necessity of understanding your market and understanding the process of getting a technology through the different steps to clinical application and understanding each of those steps and most importantly, the end game, which is the overall market. And that's clearly evolved even from the Hartbort days. I mean, now it's significantly more complicated. And that's what the challenge is that you and I in our ecosystem continue to, I mean, I struggle with. I think you probably do too.
Yeah.
And that struggle isn't getting easier.
No, I think that's one I remember being, I think when I was working at Hartbort, I was kind of excited by the potential impact, how this can, you know, make life so much easier for the patient. And quickly I learned that patient is not the only one that can, you know, you cannot just, you know, make sure that the patient survives, but there's so many other constituents that you have to also understand. So that's what the market that you're talking about, understanding all the players, like make sure all the stars are aligned.
It's a little bit of a sad commentary. Because at the end of the day, we really, really do want to not lose focus
on a patient.
On the patient. And I still, with all the companies and projects that I mentor, I continue to drill that into them that it first and foremost has to be really, really beneficial for the patient.
Yeah.
And now there's a lot of other boxes that need to be checked. But if you don't start with that.
Right. Then it's a given, I think, with patient. Like, you know, it has to be there, but then everything else needs to be there too in order to be able to deliver that technology to a patient.
Unfortunately, it's kind of like a pyramid. The patient's
yeah.
right at the top of the pyramid, but you need a lot of other boxes underneath to hold up that top of the pyramid.
Yeah, so I'm always driven by the patient impact, the impact to patient, but the reality, there's so many other things as well. So after a Hartbort, you know, disappointment or blowout or whatever that you call it. You know, I think some people, if it's a good, uh, if it's a good experience for me. Many people start another company as well, and you know, you also start a company after Hartford as well. So how's that experience?
I did, but it comes back to the fact of what I was just referring back to, that Hartford really was the launch for many different technologies. And while I was at Hartford and they were starting, they really became very focused, as you know, on doing the port access bypass. And that, as a cardiologist, really wasn't very interesting. Mm. And even while I was at Hartford, a couple of us, including Jan Kantebeter, who was a veterinary surgeon who worked there, and Michi Garrison, who was a great engineer, the three of us would get together on weekends and talk about other projects. And we talked a little bit about going back to the aortic project, but the one that really caught my attention, and it caught it because of the elegance and the complexity and the challenge, but also what I felt was a large clinical unmet need, was the mitral valve. And so even while I was at Hartford, with the help of Jan and Michi, we started noodling around with some different ideas as to do initially a mitral valve replacement or a mitral annuloplasty. Mm-hmm. And I, at one point, approached my friend Jeff Granger, who was the in-house intellectual property lawyer at Hartford, and I showed him a few of these ideas. And Jeff, I owe a lot to Jeff, because he said, "Fred, you better take this elsewhere. This probably won't be able to be developed here, and this is worth some real energy and some resources." And so, through his help, I actually scripted a letter of separating myself from Hartford.
Okay.
And what really worked out nicely was that the idea that I eventually came up with to start this eval project, I came up with after I had left Hartford, specifically to do what's called an edge-to-edge mitral valve repair, because the classic approach to when the mitral valve leaks, it's a technical problem. Mm-hmm. It's a structural abnormality, and medicines don't help. So really the only thing that works is surgery. Surgery where the surgeon typically would either cut out a little part of the leaflet and then put a ring and tighten down, or replace the valve. And that's pretty complex open heart surgery. And in 1991, a really clever Italian surgeon by the name of Ottavio Alfieri was working one morning on a woman who had a hole in her heart between the atrium, and it was called an ASD. And when he was fixing her, he saw that her mitral valve was fused in the middle, and it's a congenital abnormality. That afternoon, he was working on doing a very complex mitral repair on a patient. He couldn't get the good result, so he actually just threw a stitch in the middle and did what is now called an Alfieri repair, which is where you basically suture the middle of the two leaflets, the mitral valve is two leaflets, right where the leak is, and make a double orifice valve. And he went on to develop this technique. Wasn't done much in this country. And I heard about it after I'd left Hartford in the fall of 1998. And it was actually one of those light bulb moments, yeah. Christine, because I thought, oh my goodness, that's so simple. That's so elegant. And I was working with a company called Pertlose at the time in terms of doing catheter-delivered sutures. And I said, let's do that. Let's just deliver on the end of a catheter a suture and repair the mitral valve.
And that's the eval story.
So that was the nidus of eval. That was the idea that I then took on a piece of paper to an IP lawyer. We looked around. Nobody seemed to be working in the space. And then I took that idea to my dear friends, Hanson Giffen and Gifford and Alan Will. Mm-hmm. And I had actually met with them 4 months before. They were starting a new incubator called The Foundry. Right. And I had brought an annuloplasty concept that I was working on for the mitral, and the good news is they didn't want that. They sent me away. And that I came back within this new edge-to-edge repair concept, and that I thought we could deliver that with a catheter. It was simple, it was elegant, it had all the makings of a percutaneous approach to repair the mitral valve. And that time the dating worked, and we got together and basically started eval. The three of us together.
I see. And there's a lot of people from Hartford did join the eval.
There was a lot of folks. Again, as we were saying, I mean, Hartford had been a great launching pad in teaching people, and a group of them came over because Hanson Gifford had been the head of research and R&D at Hartport, so it made sense that he brought in
a lot of the folks. Right.
And then we spent about a year and a half working on a very complex surgical approach. And the next light bulb moment was when we realized that, gosh, let's not use sutures because we're doing this on a beating heart, mm-hmm. Threading catheters in up through the vein, crossing from the right atrium to the left atrium and then moving around. And we had these sharp things. Maybe we should just do something that was much blunter. And in fact, the systems that we stabilized the leaflets with before we threw the sutures through, that system resolved in our models. We had some beautiful models, resolved the microregurgitation. So some very smart Stanford engineers said, well, let's just make a little clip. Let's just a little clothespin. Mm-hmm. And that design that we came up with in 2001 is very similar to what we're still now using, almost 20 years later.
Right, so Abbott acquired.
Yeah, and that's a very rocky road because, again, just the same issues that Hartport had faced, eValve did too, is it was a dramatically disruptive technology. Mm-hmm. And of course, the surgical community was screaming bloody murder because they thought, just they had seen it, what happened in the angioplasty world and the vessel space, they thought, oh my God, the same thing's gonna happen in the valve space. And so I basically had to unlist my phone number because they were coming after us. They had very strong supporters in the FDA. They had and it really was supporting the surgical agenda, and they felt that this was basically unethical what we were doing to the mitral valve as compared to what they could do with surgery.
Because the eValve has a long journey.
Well, that's what I'm saying. That was back 2001. We did our first patient in 2003, and interestingly, but to get to when we did our final submission 10 years later to the FDA, we had a lot of dancing around with them. There were basically 2,500 cases done, most of which were in Europe because we had just done some here. And we continue to run into significant resistance in both the surgical community and cardiology community because they thought it was too dramatic a paradigm shift. And at the end of the day, the data had to stand on its own.
Right.
And we got far luckier than I could have ever imagined because it...
What do you mean far luckier?
Well, I think that those of us who were involved in the beginning of that project, and this is a message to the folks listening, is it's not bad to think small and think focused and really hone in on that as you're working and then don't move off in different directions. But we really felt that this technology had a lot of attractive features to it, but probably had only a small clinical population who would really benefit. We didn't have an appreciation of the breadth of communication, part and parcel because the surgical community wasn't doing surgery on what is about 70% of the patients who have a leaky mitral valve are heart failure patients or functional when the valve itself isn't structurally abnormal, it's just stretched. Mm-hmm. And that's a very common problem. So we, because of our surgical allies who were consulting with us, said, no, go after what's called the degenerative or primary mitral regurgitation space. And so that was all our early trials, and that's what he had to work through the FDA with. And that's what happened in 2013. We ended up getting initial approval for just the degenerative. Mm. On the other hand, in Europe, they had blanket approval. And over there, right in the get-go, they got approval in 2007, started using it in 2008. By 2010, 70% of the patients having it performed on them were functional. In the meantime, we got our approval in 2013. We then had to do what turned out to be a five-year trial called the COAPT on 600 patients, randomized half to medical therapy and half to the clip. And I mean, it's really one of the landmark cardiovascular trials. Right. It took 5 years to do. And
it made it to New York Times, though.
It did, and that's it. There's a good story there, too. And it was presented then in October of 2018 at TCT, and I'll never forget sitting in the audience, next to Liz McDermott, who was the had followed the whole regulatory process, and she was one of the real drivers. And there were, I don't know, 5,000 or 6,000 people in the audience. And when Greg Stone put up the slide of the difference in mortality, and the first line that went up was medical therapy, and that was, you know, 48% of people after 2 years died, even though they had perfect medical therapy. And then the next line went up, and it was a 38% decrease in mortality. And basically, people cheered. And there were a few trials that I've sat in the audience, and people cheered the results. And we almost were like crying. And, and then, you know, as you said, it certainly got a lot of press. And the next day, it was on the front cover of the New York Times. And interestingly, the article right next to it on the front page, there was a picture of Tiger Woods, and he won his first tournament in 5 years, which I thought was kind of entertaining. But the reason I mention that is because they basically described his success as equal part methodical and magical. Mm. So I took that quote and I sent that to the whole eValve team that day in congratulating them and saying, yeah, you could say the exact same thing about the mitral flip, equal part methodical and magical.
Yeah.
This podcast is sponsored by Ron Ratnick's Global Life Sciences Group, a team of legal professionals that helps life science companies, lenders, and investors around the world turn good science into good business. Learn more at brownratnick.com.
And it's a long journey, and you know, the fact that you keep at it and have the ability to keep at it, that takes a lot of methodical.
Well, it's, you know, and again, messaging to people listening is it takes a tremendous amount of perseverance and passion. And I think it's so important that teams truly believe in what they're doing and that they hopefully have a clear understanding of what the clinical benefit is and that they then embrace and enjoy the process. And because if you find the process onerous, it's not worth doing. And it shouldn't be onerous if you really understand the number of people who, if you are successful and effective at whatever your therapy is that you're evolving or diagnostic, whatever, that if you keep that in mind, then it inspires the perseverance and the passion and the drive.
Yeah, no, that I don't know if you have the numbers, how many patients have been treated with.
So we're over 100,000 now. We're over 50 countries. And the hockey stick has really ticked up in terms of use. And it's growing weekly. And I always get little pings when new hospitals start doing it. And it's fun to see. But it's become a standard of care for an evolving subset of patients. Clearly, it's not everyone, not every pathology of mitral regurgitation. But what's fun to also finally see is, as an inventor, as an early pioneer, I loved what our first designs were. I give a lot of credit to an incredible team that came up with that design. But within a short period of time, it wasn't hard to appreciate that we could do better. Mm-hmm. We could make that design even better. And that was something that really was burning inside me. And yet we had to be very focused on getting our clinical work done, our trial work done. And then when we were acquired in 2009 by Abbott, of course, their focus was commercialization and making the product as effectively as possible, making sure it worked all the time. And there was a what I call kind of the dark ages when they really weren't inspired to improve or upgrade the clip, even though I would come back to them from time to time. And then in the last, I'd say 5 years, they've done an incredibly good job. And we are now on the fourth generation and got the fifth generation is in development of the clip. And now there's, you know, basically four different sizes. And there's all a lot of ideas that a group of us, including me, Qin Yan, early on, had even talked about are coming to fruition. And the beauty of that, and this is what's, again, fun and a message for people who are working on projects and be optimistic that things do evolve. The beauty of that is, again, where we thought there might be a fairly limited clinical applicability population in whom you could use it, that has just continued to grow and grow.
Right.
and we really can use it in a lot of situations which early on we didn't think were going to be possible.
I always think that the more you do, the more opportunity you see. Because I think sometimes you're not even aware what's out there until you do it. So I know that, so with the Heartport, with good success with Evolve, you're involved with the Fogarty Institute. Is that where you start working with the Fogarty Institute or before that?
Well, let me explain what the Fogarty Institute is, Christine, because I'm not sure. It's probably well known in the 5 miles around it, but maybe not beyond that. So I think probably most of our listeners know who Tom Fogarty is. He's really he's the godfather of medtech innovation. He's, you know, in his mid-80s now, and he started 55 years ago. He developed the Fogarty balloon catheter.
Right. We had him on our podcast.
Oh, so they know him well. That's great. Now that helps a lot. And then, did he mention his institute when he talked? But
a little bit.
Because it's really a fascinating institute. And it's a really, really important institute, and for several reasons. That is, so Dr. Fogarty, a very celebrated cardiothoracic surgeon, sort of evolved, and he eventually had a sandbox up in Portola Valley, had a few engineers, and he was working on a few projects. And every couple of years, he'd spin off one company or another. And someone at the community hospital just south of Stanford, it's called El Camino, really great community hospital in Mountain View, so really right in the center of Silicon Valley. A woman who was doing business development there approached Dr. Fogarty and said, Dr. Fogarty, would you consider coming, if we give you space in the community hospital, would you consider bringing your idea and maybe start, preferably a not-for-profit, to help young entrepreneurs make a difference, to create an inspiring and supportive environment. And this was now 12 years ago. Mm-hmm. And it resonated with him, came in, and he did give the early funding for it and doubted. And it has evolved. And it's evolved so that we have about 10 companies typically at a time. They'll come in for between 1 and 3 years with us. And they typically come in with one or two people with no funding at all, and we help them get funded, we help them do the process. And it's a group of sort of seasoned mentors who are working with them, who all donate their time for the most part. And though there's an administrative structure, and then 3 years ago, we took it up another notch, and we brought in a CEO, Andrew Cleland, who has had $2 billion exits already. And when I was trying to convince him to do this, I said, Andrew, you don't need another $1 billion exit. What you really need to do is repair a damaged ecosystem. Mm-hmm. And I think that's probably something that, I mean, you could probably talk on as long as I could about the damaged ecosystem. But basically, when I was starting companies 20 years ago, it was hard, but it wasn't that difficult to go up to Sand Hill Road. If you had a couple of good engineers and a couple of good ideas, people, you could get a little money and you could start things. It doesn't happen anymore. It doesn't happen. You can't, with a good idea, just immediately get funding. You really have to take things farther down the road. You need to prove the concept, and you need to develop ideas that have, and then even early clinical work. And the concept was to, on a community hospital campus, create a safe space for these companies to come in and work, interface very seamlessly with physicians, with engineers, with regulatory people, and all the Rolodex, you know, your Rolodex and my Rolodex. There are a lot of people who are willing to just give their time, which is amazing. And to get these young, bright, inspired engineers and CEOs and what we call them CIRs, company in residence teams, further along. Yeah. And we've been doing it now for 12 years, and it's been really rewarding. I was pulled in sort of 10 years into it because my office was turned out to be right across the hall, and the very first company, a company called HeartFlow, had transitioned from the peripheral vascular space into the heart space, and they needed a cardiologist, so I got involved. And then I realized this was a wonderful place and a great opportunity for me to give back and to work with companies and to share as much my failures, because I certainly, we could talk a long time about my failures and as well as successes. Yeah. I mean, as we both know, you learn significantly more from failures. And it's a very supportive community, and it's an institute that focuses not only on these companies, it focuses a lot on the individuals and mentoring and nurturing them. And then also we have a strong component of education. And we have a summer internship program where 16 college kids come in and we put them in the companies. Four times a year for FDA, reviewers come and spend a week with us and we put them in a company and they learn. And that's so important, Christine, because there's just this gap between the FDA and the companies often, and there's a lack of communication and a lack of and just language disparity. And we're finding by just breaking down the barriers and sitting together and talking about it. And these folks frequently then go back to the FDA and they're the Fogarty Fellows or the Fogarty Ambassadors, and they talk about sort of the startup process and they share that. So it's an institute that is playing a very important role in trying to address what continues to be higher and higher barriers, addressing those higher and higher barriers for getting really important technologies into clinical practice.
Yeah, and we do need those technologies still. You know, we still need, you know, more, better technology to solve a lot of the problem that, you know, we still face.
Well, so you couldn't be more precise about that. And when I just look at the number of companies that used to knock on our door 6 and 8 years ago, and now when we, you know, sort of, you know, we throw out the word that we're looking at companies, and I think we got last time we had like 70 companies, and it's extremely difficult. I'm so glad. It makes me feel very glad that I'm not like in the college admissions office or the medical school admissions office. How they say no to, because we have the exact same process. I mean, we do diligence, and you know, out of those 60 companies, we pick, you know, 3 or 4 only. Right. And it's becoming increasingly challenging, difficult, because we could fill the institute probably 3 or 4 times over with the quality of good ideas and good people who come through.
Yeah. Unfortunately, resources are limited. And so sometimes, you know, it pains me sometimes to also, like, you know, we cannot help, we cannot bring everybody in, and because of the limited resources that we have. But we try to... at the Roseman Institute, we try to do the same. Like, you know, there's an education piece that we want to be open to everybody. And I think everybody can benefit from it too. So I know that before we end our conversation, I know you're dabbling or involved now in the global health aspect of things. So it's a bit in the market outside the United States. Can you tell us more about that activity that you're doing?
Yeah, just very briefly, because I think you probably do want to wind down here. But one of the frustrations I've had is I've been involved with several truly impact projects, therapies that could have a dramatic impact on global health, and especially in the lower income countries. And what I'm finding is, even though it's clearly obvious that the technologies are going to help and they're easily applicable and they are efficient and very effective, that the barriers to get those technologies into these different places is even higher than the barriers we have in this country. And it's especially in, for instance, I've taken a new interest in the maternal and infant health space and the obstetrical space, because there's a lot of opportunity. And just it's devastating, the maternal and infant morbidity evolved with obstetrics around the world that we just don't have any appreciation for. In fact, I'm working in Burundi with a hospital there where the maternal mortality is 1 in 23.
Wow.
It's 50 times higher than in Europe. And just with small incremental changes, small technologies, therapy, and education, we can have a difference. So I'm very excited to work on some of these projects, specifically focusing on the issue of how can we improve the system? How can we get these technologies? So I'm going to be working with an innovation center we're building in Rwanda, which is a fascinating East African country, and Burundi and several other places, India and Singapore. And it's a challenge where I'm personally excited by it, because when I look about where can I have a little impact and sort of take advantage of the incredible privilege and fortune I've had, and to scale it, I think there's some opportunity. Mm-hmm. And so in my next iteration here, that's where I'm going to certainly put a lot of energy and focus.
That sounds really exciting. And hopefully whatever that you learn here can be applied to
Well, hopefully what I can learn from you and from all the people in our wonderful ecosystem here, that we can really refine it and take advantage of it and then effectively apply it in a really global, scalable fashion.
Yeah. No, that's, you know, it takes a village. Yeah. Well, thank you so much. It's been really fun to hear your story.
No, Christine, I'm honored. Thank you for bringing me in, and it's always fun to tell these stories. And I'm sure we could go on and on, the two of us together, for a long time. But thank you for including me in this.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you for listening today, and don't forget to subscribe to our podcast on iTunes.